We would love to get to a Bitcoin standard. Yes, it would be probably, in my view, a better system because you just take away that inflationary burden. But the path from here to there, path dependency is so important because how do you actually get to that approach? It's like the concept of, you know, de-dollarization, right? Yes, there are some countries who want to move away from the US dollar, but if it was easy, they would have done it already.
Hello and welcome to Bitcoin with Jake. Listen in to hear from Bitcoiners dispersed all across the globe whose personal journeys I leverage to gain conviction in an ongoing due diligence process. I need to take a moment to mention our sponsors. Orange Pill app is for those of us that want to meet Bitcoiners. Dubbed Bitcoin Social Layer, it helps you connect in an ultra-local fashion whilst also curating suitable events nearby. Check out episode 48 to hear the journey of Mateo, the founder of Orange Pill app, in case you need any more excuses to sign up. Hardblock is an Australian Bitcoin exchange. They've been serving the community from as far back as 2014, never got sucked into the dubious world of altcoins, and continue to be one of the industry leaders down under. Check out episode 17 to hear from Daniel Wilczynski, the founder of Hardblock, for a more in-depth background. Now, let's get on with today's show. Today, I've got James Check. Hey, James, how are you?
G'day, Jake. Thanks for having me on.
No, my pleasure. We met in person at Bitcoin Alive, and here we are a week or so later having a recording. So it's great to get together and hear more of your story. It's a fleeting glimpse at a conference like that, isn't it? You don't get time to necessarily find out what this person does or exactly how they got to that point, and suddenly you hear them making presentations. And so really keen to hear what the story is. So I would start in the same way. If you could wind the clock back, where were you? What were you doing when you first came across Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I think most people probably have a similar story in the sense that you come in near the top. So I was a child of the 2018 bear market. And on the recommendation of one of my very good friends, you know, you've got to get into this crypto thing. You got to come in, like, everything's going up. Of course, this is the main year of 2017. And you kind of sit at this thing, you're seeing it just rallying, and you're like, oh, yeah, I don't know. And then my story is, or at least my claim to fame, the very first thing I ever bought, ever. I didn't own stocks, I didn't own bonds, nothing. First thing I ever bought in my life was Ethereum at the top on Coinbase. And at the time, Coinbase had an additional fee for Australian dollars. So my initial, when you do your taxes, my purchase price is above the top tick. So it'd be pretty hard to buy at a worse position than me. But to be honest, I always, like, when I first came in, I'm sure a lot of people had the same experience. I didn't even read the white paper. I didn't click to it. I was like, oh, look, you know, I assume that there's going to be another Bitcoin, and you go looking down the list. And, you know, once you lose 90% and then you lose 90% and then you lose it again, and then you get to the November crash where you lose another 90%, you go, okay, clearly my 10 grand is worth 5 cents. I've done something very, very wrong. Now, what I did do during that period of time is I became fascinated with markets, right? As you're kind of learning about it, and, you know, in many ways, this market moves at a pace that you just don't see, like the volatility, you'll see chart patterns and all the like play out, stuff that takes months. Or, you know, if you look at gold, right, it's forming a very nice cup and handle right now over like a 12-year period. And you see these things play out in this industry in weeks. So I started to really get fascinated with how markets move, right? And, you know, became fascinated with the price chart. And finally, after that capitulation in November, there was a few things starting to float around. So my background is civil engineering. And within that, a lot of it is visualizing complex problems, right? And more importantly, taking all the complexity of the engineering world and simplifying it for your client who just needs to see a picture to go, oh, okay, I understand why you're doing this thing. So price is kind of one element to it, but the world of on-chain analytics was growing up in a very, very early metrics in late 2018. And I started reading these papers. I'm like, hang on, this is kind of interesting. This is another way that you can visualize an asset and see the behavior patterns of what people are doing. Anyway, finally, I read the white paper down there, like December, like at the bottom, 2018. And it was just kind of that thing that glued everything together. I was like, okay, so I can see this price. I understand the price chart. I understand the human emotions. I can now start visualizing it with both price and on-chain. And then the macro side of things, right? The debt levels and how the monetary system works, all of it just clicked. And Bitcoin was kind of the penny dropping where you go, this makes a whole lot of sense. And pretty much from that point onwards, it absorbed 5, 10, 15, 50% of my brain power. And by the time we were saying before we started, I was in London for 2 years before the pandemic, which is a story into itself. But by the time I got back, my mind was just fixated on this thing. I'm like, this asset and where this thing is going. is just so much bigger than all of us. And there was just too many things that made sense. I'm sure in another life, if Bitcoin didn't exist, I'd be a gold bug, but it just makes too much sense. And that was kind of that moment for me, and it kind of stitched it all together.
So cool. You say everyone's story is the same, but they're not. And I asked the same question and it all goes in different directions. It's,
totally.
It's so interesting. So what we'll try and do is build up like what the picture is in terms of your base knowledge. So I saw your presentation at Bitcoin Alive and you said, actually, I was at university here. So I assume University of New South Wales is where you did your civil engineering background. So for those of us that don't really understand what that is, teach us about civil engineering. What are the kind of things you're working on? What are the skills that you get out of that? And then you can, I'm sure, move nicely into how you then represent that in a picture and how that's relevant to what we're talking about today.
Totally. So I actually started as a civil mining double. I didn't really know where to go at that point in time, but civil engineering is basically anything to do with, I mean, typically you'll see it in terms of public infrastructure, road, rail, tunnels, basements, buildings, stuff like that. So that's kind of your civil engineering realm. And then mining engineering, because at the time it would have been 2010 or 2012. During that period, it's kind of coming off the mining boom, right? They've gone through the big boom and things were really starting to quiet off. But anyway, I kind of didn't really know where I wanted to go. So I decided to do a double. Initially, I wanted to be a structural engineer, right? Which is buildings, concrete, steel, you know, bridge abutments, all that kind of thing. But I did a couple of sets of work experience through my degree. And there was one particular field that really caught my eye. So I actually did drop the mining side because when I was looking at the mining industry, you've got to live in the sticks. It's a lot of life commitment. And that just didn't quite align with where I was at the time. But there's another field of civil engineering called geotechnical. And geotechnical is kind of similar to mining, but you're dealing with the ground. Whereas a structural engineer has the advantage of you've got a foundation. You can put whatever building you want there. You can put steel there. You can choose which reinforcement you want. You're essentially playing in air. Your medium is air, and you're then using structural systems to build whatever the structure is. Geotechnical engineering, you don't have that luxury. We get the ground that we are given at that particular site. If you want to build a tunnel, you don't get to choose what the ground is. The ground just is. And in many ways, where structural engineering is adding structure to an empty space, geotechnical engineering is using the space that you currently have, removing a portion of that soil, and then filling it with, you know, foundations or footings or whatever it is. So I did that for about 8 years, and it took me down a lot of roads, right? As I said, I worked in London for a period of time on some very, very deep mine shafts, 1.6 kilometer vertical shafts. Fascinating project, and certainly an interesting foray into the world of mining engineering, which is with civil, your factors of safety are 2, 3, 5. In mining, if your shotcrete's cracking on the wall, thumbs up, because it means you're going fast, you're going hard, and you're not spending too much resources on materials. So at the end of the day, my final kind of big project, strangely enough, was actually a mining job before I threw in the towel. But I was designing everything from tunnels, footings, basements. And the thing that I loved about the geotechnical side is, first of all, you kind of have to deal with what you've got. But the other thing is, if you're doing a tunnel, for example, if you do a borehole, they're kind of like a 50 millimeter diameter hole, you find out what is in that 50 millimeter diameter hole. And then what you have to do is, you may get one of those every 100 meters. You've then got to interpolate and say, well, what is the ground between my boreholes, right? I need to design this tunnel so that the walls don't fall in. There's a lot of probability analysis. There's a lot of risk assessment. And there's a lot of complex visualization because you've got to, you know, if we're looking at sandstone, okay, well, how did the sandstone get here millions of years ago? What kind of stress did it go under when it was, obviously it was sand at first, then it became sandstone. How did the sand get there in the first place? Was it deposited by wind in sand dunes? Was it an old river system? If it's an old river system, are there going to be clay pockets and shale pockets around? So you have to actually go back through history and say, well, how did the ground get there in the first place? And look over that geological timescale. So it's very much about visualization, complex problems, and you know, basically trying to visualize in simple, easy enough to digest format, whilst also taking into account all of the risk and uncertainty that can happen. So in many ways, there's a lot of parallels. I mean, markets kind of behave very much like, you know, they're bound by the laws of gravity. They still have many of these same impacts. And you see these kind of correlations between the engineering physical world and the world of markets and human behavior, all these things, there's a lot of connection between this stuff. You can draw parallels.
And so when I hear you talk through that, it's obviously a field of knowledge that is completely abstract to me in some ways. Like, I've no idea the amount of work and intelligence it requires in terms of frameworks and knowledge to dig a huge tunnel. But what I can hear is these kind of systematized, like, curiosity lenses. It's like, we want to do this, we don't know quite how, and therefore we're going to put it through the system and figure it out. And that's what I find so interesting. So you had that base skill set and Bitcoin comes along and you're able to kind of basically pump it through that. So before we get to, you know, really figuring out Bitcoin's the way you want it to go, so how do markets react in that same vein? So you almost went down into that hole, but let's keep going. So what are the similarities then between trying to figure out how a market behaves and what you learned from being a geotechnical engineer?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. So, you know, I remember actually sitting in one of my lectures all those years ago, and one of the professors goes, you realize that many civil engineers actually end up in the finance world. And I'm sitting there like enjoying designing my steel and concrete, and be like, why would I go into finance? That doesn't make any sense. But the reason why it kind of clicks, and you actually do find a lot of civil engineers, they tend to do quite well in the finance world, is because they come at it without the textbook. They haven't done all the textbook economics, and, you know, they're not coming at this problem from a, for want of a better term, indoctrinated way, where you've kind of seen, oh, this is how we do it. And you look at the system like a machine. Actually, I think Lynn Alden talks about this quite a bit because she's got an engineering background. You kind of see the world and the mechanics of it as a machine, right? The plumbing of the financial system makes a whole lot more sense when you're looking at, you know, countries are like big corporations, right? And they're all trying to make sure their trade balance sheets are in check, and it's all about incentives and things like that. But, you know, there's a force of gravity that acts in markets, right? You never see a price chart just go in a straight line, right? It just doesn't go up in one direction or down in one direction. There's these corrections along the way, right? The market gets a little bit too hot and it pulls back, or the market sells off too quick and it bounces back. And there's mechanical reasons for why this happens. It could be that you just kind of hit, you know, a level like the 200-day moving average. Why does the 200-day moving average, and if you go back and look at the Bitcoin price, it reacted to the 200-day moving average before we even had TradingView, right? Before we even had a price chart. So why does it do that? Well, because human beings have a kind of innate feeling that, oh, this has gone a little bit, this has gone up too much in my recent memory. My recency bias kicks in. We don't know that it's 200 days, but just by gut feel, you're like, oh, it's up a lot, or it's sold off a lot from that level. It seems cheap now. So people still kind of react to these things. And then you kind of add another layer to it. Because everybody now reacts to the 200-day moving average, more and more people start to react and expect the 200-day move. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's other things, you know, like you hit these points where there's just like market liquidity. There's some areas where there's more depth. Price tends to attract towards that liquidity. And in many ways, it functions in a very kind of an organic machine. That's probably the best framework for it. Markets are a collection of all of our human decisions. And the reason why we have price charts back in the 1920s, and you can still see the same bullish, bearish chart patterns from the 1920s, and you can look at it today, and they're the same thing. Because whilst the market changes, the asset changes, the one thing that doesn't change is the ape brain that we all have. And we all respond the same way because it is a many century, thousands of year old machine that just doesn't evolve as fast as the world around us does. So yeah, it's kind of one of these things, the force of nature still exists, and it's because of all those collective decisions we make.
Fascinating. Have you ever read a book called The Reminiscences of a Stock Operator?
Anybody who's listening, if you haven't read this book, do it. Not only is it a fantastic read, but it explores this very concept. Someone who literally traded those crazy markets, stock tickers coming out on paper, and you know, learning to read the tape. It's fascinating.
And shout out to a mate of mine, Jigs, who is a, like most of us, I guess, in this Bitcoin space, completely self-taught investor. And he's really fallen down the technical side of things, much like yourself, James. He'll really enjoy this interview, so I'll make sure he gets it. But through his tutorage, in a sense, I have done some technical analysis myself. Not that I'm going to claim to be any good at it. I'll always refer to him for advice. But you start to understand, as you mentioned, that prices can only go up a certain amount or only go down a certain amount within these kind of mathematical ranges. And a lot of these mathematical ranges can be seen in biology in terms of the way that, you know, things are designed in the petal of a leaf and all sorts of other strange kind of
fractals.
You mentioned organic. It's like it's kind of the same. It's quite bizarre.
There's a good example. We can probably touch on this later on. When it comes to on-chain metrics, One of the most popular, one of the oldest, is called the realized price, right? It's the average price that every coin in the supply moved. Now, we discovered, and this is the thing, we might even touch on this as well, but like, you know, how much of Bitcoin do you discover versus invent? And in this instance, when I look at many of the metrics, I believe we discover them. And much the same, you know, at Bitcoin Alive, as you gave the talk, is Bitcoin an invention or a discovery? And in many ways, it's discovery because it was just kind of putting all the bits of the puzzle. It was always there. It just needed to be put together. Anyway, the realized price, this is kind of the average price of everyone's coins, like the cost basis. Mm-hmm. And if you go back and look at 2015, we didn't know about this metric, and yet price reacted to it for a whole year down in 2015. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of one of these things that people don't know that they're buying and selling at their cost basis, but it's innately each individual's doing their own decision making. So at an individual level, sure, your cost basis can be all over the place, but on aggregate, the average behavior of all of us, that kind of distributed organism that is hitting buy, sell, trade, send, we are all making decisions. And as a collective, we kind of make the decision that creates the Bitcoin price chart and the on-chain data set, which is kind of a fascinating concept.
Wow. And have you read a book called The Wisdom of Crowds?
No, but I've heard people refer to it before. Yeah,
I've not finished it, I must confess. But what I did read of it, it gave an excellent example of a traditional kind of fair. And there was a bull, or I can't remember the animal. I think it's a bull. And basically, they have a competition and you have to guess the weight of the cow. And everyone chucks in their ideas. And, you know, you've got the best cowman in the country stood there having a look. And you've also got complete punters. And the cowman can be completely wrong, even with all the expert knowledge. And some total punter will come along and, you know, might get close and win the prize. But the average of all of the bets is actually the closest.
This is why free markets work.
This is the extraordinary kind of concept that we're really discussing. You're like, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. And you start to see it in all sorts of places. So James, I'd like to rewind to a comment that you made that I really resonate with as well, which is you said that your mind became fixated on this thing and your mind share, you know, goes 5, 10, 15, suddenly 50%. Before you know it, it's all you want to kind of research, read and work on. So talk us through how you ended up at that point.
It kind of comes back to the how Bitcoin's a little bit of a polymath where you kind of touch human incentives, you touch markets, finance, monetary systems, now energy grids coming into it. It's just fascinating how Bitcoin touches so many components of life, and not just, you know, not kind of trivial components, truly meaningful parts of how society functions and operates. And there's a lot of credit to be given to Saifedean's book, The Bitcoin Standard. So once I read the white paper, I was like, all right, I need to look more into this thing. But when you read The Bitcoin Standard, there's, you know, when you understand that this is kind of like first principles, really taking it back to that engineering structure of why did people choose gold, right? And why didn't we continue to use seashells? And you kind of run those very simple thought experiments. And it kind of comes down to a series of axioms. You're like, I just can't dispute this thing, right? This concept of scarcity, it makes perfect sense. It makes all the sense in the world. And once you accept that as some kind of a reality, and then you look at fiat money, and you kind of see all the damage it does. And I think a challenge that we have as analysts, people observing the markets in the world, is a lot of people look at where we could be, right? The Bitcoin standard or the gold standard, where we were, but you have to factor in where we are. And that's the hard part about all this thing. It's like, we would love to get to a Bitcoin standard. Yes, it would be probably, in my view, a better system because you just take away that inflationary burden. But the path from here to there, path dependency is so important because how do you actually get to that approach? It's like the concept of, you know, de-dollarization, right? Yes, there are some countries who want to move away from the US dollar, but if it was easy, they would have done it already. They've been trying to do this for decades, and it's going to take decades and decades more. These things are like aircraft carriers in terms of ship size. It takes them a very, very long time to turn around. There's politics involved. It's tumultuous. You make progress and then the world kicks back. It is just an enormous long-term thing. It's hard to envision these long-term time cycles.
Yeah, interesting. And so was there a moment that you can kind of think back to where you were like, okay, I've got to get into this industry in some way and work in it full-time? Or was there a process that you went through? So you're now with Glassnode, right? Was that your first role within the industry? And how did you end up there?
Yeah, so that was also a bit of a journey. So in my time as an engineer, I was then a part-time content creator for a newsletter called Ready, Set, Crypto, which is still ticking along. It was kind of an education platform, right? Helping people understand these systems. Now, kind of 2019, I think I probably started up there. And actually, that's where I learned about markets, right? It was kind of one of these things back in 2018. They had a YouTube channel. I was like, yeah, these guys, you know, it's kind of interesting. I like their content. So I subscribed and it was kind of a duo. Mav did all the kind of fundamentals of what's going on in the crypto industry and Doc did the trading side. So in many ways, Doc taught me how to trade and understand markets and Mav taught me to kind of think critically about the space. Anyway, but through that process, I started producing more and more content for them. That became a part-time gig, which ticks on to this day. And you know, essentially what we're doing is just once the on-chain thing started to kick in, I was like, wow, this is fascinating. Like I can see Bitcoin, free data started coming out. I gave myself a project, which was I want to be able to chart all this on-chain data because I was downloading it, sticking in a spreadsheet and then updating all my charts, right? A very engineering approach, right? I use spreadsheets all the time. And I was like, okay, this is getting cumbersome. I need to teach myself Python. That was my project, my side project, build out Python. Learn how to code my own website. And so I can then just start charting this stuff in an automated fashion, which then became Check on Chain. So that was kind of my process, right? I started building this thing up. It was kind of a part-time gig for about 3 years. And then one of our members actually said, hey, by the way, Glassnode happens to be looking for a data scientist. To which I was like, well, I mean, I taught myself Python. I'm not going to kid myself and say I'm a data scientist, but I'll apply. I may not know data science. I may not know Python, but I do know on-chain analytics. And this is one of these things. I mean, it's only been around since late 2018. And I've been there not quite at the birth point, but I was there when the baby was brought out. And just, you know, I've been in the space long enough and spent enough time studying it and had enough of a fascination with it that people wanted to learn. And there was nowhere on YouTube, anywhere, of people teaching on-chain analytics. So I started a very, very crude, I mean, I've got a nice mic now, but back in the day, it sounded like I was sitting in a tin can doing these horrible webinars with just like slides, you know, kind of the same as what I'm doing now, but just teaching people, what is the realized cap? How do you use this thing? And there was no one else doing it. And it just has kind of grown from there.
Awesome. What I can feel very clearly and often is the way with these conversations I have is passion. And passion is something that is so rare, but also so important. And if you come across a subject that you're passionate about, then it doesn't matter if it's 10 o'clock at night. You're still happy to kind of work on it. It's not a chore. And that takes you to amazing places. And suddenly people start to notice and other people get value from it. And it's just this kind of awesome flywheel that sends you in directions you could never possibly imagine. And then suddenly you're on stage at a Bitcoin conference talking about it. You know, these things kind of all pull together. One thing I'm intrigued by with this on-chain analytics stuff, there's two directions I want to go, and let's go here first. There's a kind of privacy and censorship conversation that's incredibly important here. Talk us through, like, what are the conflicts between either side of this discussion, and how do you see that yourself?
Yeah, no, this is a really interesting one. The way to look at these things, the on-chain or the UTXO set is essentially a public database. Now, like anything, how you choose to use that database is then dependent on your end goals. So when we're talking about things from the Glassnode perspective, we're very much the best frame of reference is it's like economics. More correctly, I think, behavioral economics. We are looking at the collective decisions. We're not looking at, oh, that is Jake's transaction to Binance and that is that guy's transaction over here. We're looking at how many transactions were there? What was the transaction volume? What was the total transaction volume into Binance? Are we seeing more inflows from Binance to Coinbase? Are we seeing people hodling their coins? You kind of take away the individual component and it's all aggregated data. Let's look at how much volume you can break down the volume into. You know, we often look at things in terms of age. We don't care that it's Jake. We care that you held your coins for 6 months. Show me all of the guys who held their coins for between 6 months and 1 year. All right, that's kind of getting into hodler territory. Now show me everyone who's held their coins for 2 weeks. Now we're talking about the hot money. So we kind of use these heuristics. We kind of remove that layer of we're not looking at individuals. There is another layer to, I guess, what you would call on-chain analytics as an umbrella. And that's what I would call forensics. That's the type of thing that a Chainalysis or Elliptic, they're essentially working for more or less government contracts. They work for exchanges, right? Looking for these UTXOs have been flagged by OFAC or whatever it is. That's more got to do with compliance, regulatory risk, and tracking criminals, right? So two very different fields, you know, on the left-hand side with what we do at Glassnode, that's very much about the economics. It's for traders, it's for hodlers, it's information. Whereas when you go down the path of forensics, they are indeed looking for individuals. They are seeking to break privacy. Whereas for us, we couldn't care less who you are. We're just looking at the aggregates and using clever heuristics. to kind of break down, this is Binance. That's about the limit, right? We're looking at Binance or particular miners. They're kind of the primary ones we look at, big custodians and the production side. We don't go down to individuals of, you know, specific entities and the like.
Awesome. Something that I really enjoyed learning recently, and again, shout out to Jigs for taking me down this path. But as an investor, like, two questions you've got to ask. What do you want to buy and when do you want to buy it? And when you figure out that Bitcoin's what you want to buy, you're then like, when the fuck do I buy? Because this thing is volatile. Mm-hmm. And there's something just that stings when it's like, oh, if I go all in today and the price halves, well, that's painful as hell.
It's tough.
And so, you know, how do you best manage that risk? And as investors, if you can leverage some other form of intelligence or tool, and this concept of convergence of indicators is absolutely awesome, to say, I think this is a pretty good bet that now's a good time to buy, it's incredibly helpful. So talk us through where you see that going, because that to me is incredibly cool. It's like, okay, we know we want to buy Bitcoin because, you know, sound money and the idea of this decentralized network and all of the cool reasons that we love. But when the hell do you do that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's kind of two answers to this, right? There's the when do you want to be buying or selling, right? Insert the other side if you want. If you're talking about macro scale, right? I want to be buying the bottom, selling the top. And on-chain data is absolutely fantastic for this because people tend to behave the same way. One of the few narratives that survived this cycle, which strangely enough, everyone thought was the one that was going to die, was the four-year cycle, right? Here we are having and that's why I covered it to the Bitcoin Alive conference. It was a textbook bottom, absolutely textbook, like a dotting T's, crossing I's, making sure that that thing was picture perfect. Mm. And as it was happening, I'm like, I mean, surely it has to break here, right? You're looking at FTX. It looks like a flaw in every metric we're looking at. It has to break. There's no way it can be this clear. And yet here we are up 90% year to date. So what are you looking for, right? At the very, very bottom of a market cycle, you're looking for seller exhaustion. Now, what does that look like? That looks like a complete saturation of only the hodlers who are price insensitive are left. Mm-hmm. So there's only so much red people can see in your portfolio. If you came in the 21 cycle, and you just saw your portfolio go from 60,000 cost basis all the way down to 15, there's a point in time where you see that negative 75% number, you just go, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. Mm. I hate this asset. I'm out. Mm. And a lot of people do this. They will capitulate at the exact wrong time. Mm. But simultaneously, the people who are still here and willing to carry that 75% are the people who are pretty hardcore. And if you just kind of distill it down to the real simple thing, if there's an asset that you believe in, right? Let's take Bitcoin for this example. What is the conditions that you would, from a human perspective, who do you want to be holding coins right now? Do you want people who had their, like me, their friend was saying, hey, you got to get into this crypto thing. This is amazing. What do you buy right now at the top? Or do you want people who have spent hours, thousands of hours listening to podcasts, studying, understanding its role? Like, do you want those people to be the holder base? Or do you want people who just came in and they're here for a quick buck? Mm. The answer is pretty obvious. So that works on both sides. When you have, and we can see this with, you know, great metrics like the HODL waves just shows how old is the coin supply. When you have a peak in coins older than 6 months, right? That's the HODLers. When there's a peak in the number of people who have been here for a long time, you've weathered the volatility, you survived the most brutal drawdown a long time. That, you know, they're your friends, right? That's the smart money. They are people who are going to step in, rain, hail, or shine, and buy this thing. And conversely, what is a bull market top going to look like? Maximum saturation of all these brand new buyers and those smart money who were bold enough to step in front of the FTX train and buy at 15,000. Mm. They're going to be the ones that are selling to those people. Mm. So you see the changing of the guard. And it's a process, but there's also levels that appear to be quite consistent. At a macro scale, that's kind of what you're looking for, right? Bring it back to the human beings. Who do you want to be standing in the front lines with, right? If it's the hardcore people who are here, rain, hail, or shine, that's a pretty good sign. Look for them.
And what I really love as well is when you start to understand what Bitcoin really is, with other assets, you know, an equity, it actually could go bankrupt. You know, so, oh, wicked, look, massive, massive bear market on this certain stock. And then you figure out that actually they were tampering with something and there's been some fraud. And before you know it, the entire CEO and team have been fired. And actually they've decided to sell out for 1 cent on the dollar and it's gone. The bloodiest of bear markets in Bitcoin, this thing's not dying. So, you know, that old phrase of when there's blood on the streets, you get out and start buying. Well, has there ever been a better asset than Bitcoin to do that with? I'm not sure there has.
No. And you know, there's not just the investor side. We can see the production side, right? You can see when the miners, we ran a paper recently, actually, which we called the, I think it was Estimating the Cost of Production. And we ran a bunch of models to just look at difficulty, right? Difficulty is kind of the core price of mining. It is the cost to obtain Bitcoin with power.
Yep.
And we essentially established a model, very, very simple. That is what we think kind of an average cost basis for mining. And when you look at how many days it's been profitable and how many days it's been non-profitable for miners based on that model, it's like 50-50. So it's approximating a perfect market where half the days you're in the green, half the days you're in the red. So it's a brutal free market, but you can see when these miners puke their coins out at the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. They hang on as long as they can. They finally start switching off their ASIC machines. And then eventually we saw at this cycle, all these publicly traded miners, the Core Scientifics of the world, go mm-hmm. bankrupt. Mm-hmm. And you know, the narrative before we went into this cycle is, oh, they're well capitalized. They're going to hang on to their coins. They've got US capital markets. Mm-hmm. How did that go for them? Interest rates mm-hmm. went higher. The market blew up, credit was hard to come by, and miners became toxic. So, you know, you had the exact same flush out that you see every single cycle. So it's kind of one of these beautiful things. It's both the investors and the production side both tend to behave the same way.
And in fact, so there's a couple of things I want to mention. First of all, that production side, to take another equity analysis analogy, go back to mining. Like the mining company will tell you, oh, we've got our, you know, iron ore to port at X dollars per ton. And it's like official news that the equity markets will trade on. But is it true? You know, you don't know what FMG are actually having to do to get that iron ore to port, right? Or Rio Tinto or BHP. And it's the most competitive West Australian market you can find. I actually used to be a dry bulk ship broker. So a lot of the mining business you would have looked at, I was part of that at a shipping perspective. But that's where Bitcoin is so different, right? So you've got this visibility on the production side. But the other angle is actually users. And this is a path I'd love to go down next, which is, what are the kind of things you're looking for in terms of user growth? And one of the things I've loved about this podcast is speaking to people in, you know, different countries in Africa, for example, or Central America, where financial systems, they're just hopeless, right? And product market fit for Bitcoin is best in those places. But how do you actually know how many people are joining the Bitcoin network? What are the kind of metrics that really make it glaringly obvious that this thing growing, regardless of the price and regardless of when, you know, the New York Times says it's frying the earth?
Yeah, totally. So there's probably two key points there. One, and credit where it's due, Chainalysis do a very good adoption report. I think they do it annually. And they often look at geographical distribution. They say, you know, where is adoption growing the most? And it is consistently showing that in the poorest parts of the world, where their monetary systems do not work and corruption is rife, that the per capita, not per dollar, but per capita adoption is massive. Some of these places, you know, Indonesia and Nigeria, 30 odd percent adoption levels. This is enormous. And, you know, in many instances, the G20 barely shows up in the top 30 adoption countries, which to me is fantastic, right? At a per capita level. And quite often, you know, you mentioned people who like to rail against Bitcoin. Convince me that the people who are in those developing worlds and choosing to use this, they're not forced to use it, they're choosing to, convince me that they're wrong, because you can't, right? They're choosing to use this system because it is better than what they currently have, and it is helping them in a tough spot. So that's kind of on the, I guess, the geographical adoption side. When it comes to metrics and tools that I like to use, we've recently started using, we try to simplify it, because obviously on-chain data, in fact, any data, any analysis, it's complex. There's lots of moving pieces. You kind of have to get your head around the jargon, stuff like that. So me and my team, we like to build what we call kind of concepts that simplify the idea. So we use a particular format for these kind of on-chain activity. That's the category, transactions, volume, address counts, all this kind of thing. Anything that's showing how alive the Bitcoin network is. We use a tool that we call Momentum. And that's really simple. You take the one-year moving average, and you take the 30-day moving average, right? Monthly versus the yearly. Is the current month, the last month, higher than the yearly? And you see these really nice charts where it's, you know, typically speaking during a bear market, you will see a collapse in the 30-day moving average below the 1 year. And you can say, well, we've seen a flush out. There are less users. There are less transactions. There's less going on. Probably a bad sign. A great example, we saw this happen back in April 2021, right? Before that first sell-off. and it never recovered. In the November, October high, it never recovered to that same level. And to me, that now, I will never forget that moment, because as we're rallying to 69,000, we just didn't have the adoption carry through. There wasn't the same kind of momentum on chain. And I was debating with myself, because I'm like, but it's an all-time high, but it's just not there. And anyway, by about January, I'd completely flipped and said, no, it was telling us that there was not enough adoption to sustain this next leg higher. So it's a really nice way to just visualize and see with just two very simple lines, is the monthly more than the yearly? If true, it's probably a good sign that you're seeing a burst of adoption coming in, which we have seen of late, which is good to see.
Okay, cool. And so I'll just bring in now, I've got an audience question. So Mike Dunworth, shout out to Mike, wherever he is today.
Great presentation, by the way, on Bitcoin Alive.
Yeah, it was awesome, wasn't it? Cosmic Mike, as I call
it. I've never, ever thought about that concept of time-locking funds into the future. That's brilliant.
Well, yeah, and anyone listening that hasn't come across that, dig out my episode with Mike, because he talks through it. It's a fascinating concept. So his question, if Bitcoin were a website with users and every wallet with a balance is considered a user, then what does the ideal Bitcoin wallet activity look like? Is it self-custody, exchange activity, et cetera? I.e., what is the ideal wallet behavior we should look forward to as a KPI? Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it's a very interesting question. I think there's two answers there. The ideological one, and then there's what I like to say when we talk about any kind of analysis, the right tool for the right job. So what is the ideal wallet? Well, one that's active, one that somebody's buying and holding or spending. Bitcoin is such a free market. Do whatever you want with it. The KPI is, are you finding value from Bitcoin? So in that way, basically any address that's moving funds around is a totally valid user. In terms of the more market-driven perspective, it depends what you want to see. If you want to see a market that is probably forming some kind of a market floor, you want to see people basically taking coins out of exchanges, sticking them in their wallet, and sitting tight. If you want to see a market top, you'll see people sending coins in and out of exchanges all day. It's a highly active, highly liquid, speculative type wallet. So you kind of look at the balance. How many do I have of person A versus person B? And it's a spectrum that deviates alongside price. Typically speaking, when we get to the all-time high, at that point in time, we still have a huge proportion of those hodlers. As you break the all-time high, the amount of hodlers starts to decay rapidly. They literally sell as we move into the next leg higher. It's a very, very common pattern that's repeated cycle after cycle. So it's an interesting question. In terms of like, what is the ideal? Like from an ideological perspective for me, I'm a big proponent of self-custody. I think people should be experimenting with these things. I've certainly been playing, you know, ordinals come out, create a couple of ordinal inscriptions, right? See what this technology can do and where it can take us. I think people who are exploring ideas, using it for commerce, self-custody, I think is key, and also keeping it simple, right? So I think Nunchuck is a wallet I've been playing around with recently. Really, really simple to do multi-sig, right? With hardware, with software wallets, just experimenting with what the technology can do, and kind of the ideal wallet is someone who's found a way to use Bitcoin that helps them in their personal circumstance. And that is a completely variable situation. Some people will prefer custody, right? But it's a process of, you know, if you've got $100, it doesn't really matter, right? If you start getting a larger and larger position, then you move from an exchange to a mobile wallet, from a mobile wallet to a hardware wallet, and then from a hardware wallet to one that's got a, you know, passphrase and all that kind of thing. Your security setup and how you use the system scales over time. Some people will then have kind of their cold storage, their warm storage, and then stuff that they have on their mobile, right? A couple of $100 they can spend around and show people, oh, you know, you've never had Bitcoin? Here, try this. And you send them some.
And that's such a powerful organic process. I did it just recently to my friend in the gym. This is a cool thing to think as well. So the ideal wallet, of course, is different based on the person's needs. And when looking at the technology adoption curve, the early adopters and then the kind of the people that come in after that, the types of wallets that the different characteristics of adopter will require are different. So I'm intrigued as to where you think we are in terms of adoption and like to try and define that. Like, it's hard to do so, but you know, if Bitcoin's going to be the future base layer of the financial system, how far away are we from people like casually using it as if, you know, it's totally normal? And where do you see like on that curve? Because you read a Croesus article and he breaks it down excellently and we're not even 1%.
I would agree with that. I think we're just so unbelievably early, simply because there's a lot of people who haven't got to the point of understanding the what is money question, right?
Yep.
Just getting to that root base layer. And in many ways, that what we were talking about before, where you know, you see the highest adoption in Nigeria and parts of Latin America, they are forced to learn it because the system doesn't work for them. People will come to terms with, you know, the concept of inflation, to be honest, many people in the West, certainly people here in Australia, have not dealt with that problem in their whole life, right? Mm. Most people who are going to be, you know, millennials will have never, ever seen inflation in their entire life. They've never seen a recession. They've never seen inflation. And now when you've got both of those two things looming, suddenly your whole worldview has to shift and change, right? Mm. In many ways, it's kind of a process of what people's life experiences are as to whether it clicks for them or not. Another thing that I've noted, lots of people in the US, because the world operates in a US dollar standard, have literally never had to do a currency conversion except for when they go on holidays. Whereas even here, you know, in Australia, they will tell us what the exchange rate is of the Aussie dollar versus other currencies, right? Mm, mm. Because it's a piece of information that affects, because we're a commodity-driven country, it affects what's going on in the stock market, right? Mm. So we're not quite there at the point where we have to be exchanging in our head all the time. I will never forget when you first come into Bitcoin and you're trying to understand the like something to BTC ratio, and you're like, this is all these zeros. Like, what? I can't get my head around it. And then at the next kind of level on top of that is you look at everything in terms of a ratio, because if gold mining stocks are underperforming gold, the asset, that's information. You should be holding gold, not the miners. If Bitcoin miners are underperforming Bitcoin. So you can start to look at the world as a relative trade, and then you're like, oh, okay. So basically everything is going down against Bitcoin over any kind of meaningful time frame. There's signaling that something is going on there that is telling you that Bitcoin is strengthening against all of these currencies and all these other assets.
Which is so exciting. And no one, I mean, at least personally for me, my audience will know this. I got trained to make money going through business school, et cetera. You know, the tutelage of my father and a family business growing up. But I never, ever asked the question, what is money?
It's amazing, isn't it? We're recording the day after Anzac Day. And for anyone who doesn't know, we play two up here. It's illegal any other day of the year. In honor of the soldiers, you wave around notes on top of your head and you take side bets on a coin flip. One thing I will say is that the Australian currency, whilst it's still a shit coin, it's one of the best looking shit coins in cash. Like it's hardy plastic, and you can see someone's waving around a pineapple, someone's got a 20, they stand out. So at the very least, they got the design right.
Awesome. James, so I love the question, ask a man what he owns, not what he thinks. And so take this as literally as you want, per se, but when you have all of this wealth of information at your fingertips, and I'm sure you're able to monetize this intelligence, because there are plenty of investors out there that just don't understand what they're looking at, but also people who are trying to trade this particular market. How do you approach it from a personal investment perspective? And what's the kind of best practice for people to think through, do you think?
So the first thing, I mean, I've certainly dabbled with trading, and I certainly can do it. The challenge is it consumes a huge amount of brain power. So whilst they could do it, the reality is that the vast majority of people, certainly at a professional level, to be a professional trader, there is a very small subset of society that is well geared towards that profession. It is extraordinarily challenging. You have to be extremely disciplined, keep journals. It is a rigorous and challenging pastime or job. So I've certainly dabbled with it. I certainly use the tools that I have at my disposal to make better entries, right? If I see that the market's overheated, if I'm going to do a dollar cost average, I'll wait for the best opportunity that month. I'm not going to just go and buy on the day I get paid. I will wait and say, okay, do we actually have a bit of overheated or kind of selling off and looking like it's going to get a bit of a bounce? So I will look for opportunities in that space. For me personally, what I basically found in my journey is I could trade, but it consumes so much of my energy. And at the end of the day, I don't feel satisfied. What I found far superior for me personally is actually to generate additional streams of income and spend my time producing stuff to help others understand what's going on, mm-hmm. which for the on-chain side of things, it's building tools. It's helping people understand the concepts, helping take what is a very jargon-filled discipline, but making it more approachable and building the tools that people may not have thought of to then take into their own format. So that was how I kind of dealt with it, at least for Bitcoin. I found that it calmed my mind a lot more to actually focus on building value and helping people understand the market and the tools for their own work and removing kind of the trading mindset, because I just felt like it wasn't productive, right? I could make money doing it, but I didn't enjoy it. And I'm a big proponent of if you enjoy what you do, you're not working.
Awesome. And so a question from earlier that crossed my mind that would be cool to just talk through briefly is, so we're talking about on-chain on the Bitcoin-based chain. What we're not talking about is layer two, things like Lightning. So how do you see that playing out in the future in terms of this analytics that you're able to do?
Yeah, no, this is a really interesting question and one that I actually very much look forward to how it evolves. So the answer is, it kind of depends where the world of layer twos go, right? So for the Bitcoin-based chain, the UTXO set is basically a database that's a snapshot at every single block height. So you're looking at changes in the UTXO set between each block height. Mm-hmm. When you move to something like Lightning Network is not a blockchain. So what that means, it doesn't have state. So the UTXO set concept in Lightning Network doesn't exist. And not only that, like the mempool, there is no the mempool. There is your node's mempool and my node's mempool. Every mempool is unique depending on the rules. And it's kind of similar for Lightning Network. There are many Lightning Networks. If you and I set up a channel between each other, but our nodes are not connected to anybody else, you and I have a Lightning Network that is not connected to the rest of the Lightning. It can be, but it's not. So the Lightning Network is very different. If you're actually operating a routing node and there are payments zipping in and out of your particular node, you will have a lot more visibility than an observer. So for example, at Glassdoor, we've got a lot of metrics looking at Lightning Network. We can see the Lightning Network graph. We can see all the connections and all the channels that are public. You can run tests and look at what is the average fee to send coins from one side to the other. Mm. But what you can't see is all the transactions bouncing around unless you have a node that is participating in those transactions. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different beast. And if we roll this clock forward, there will be a whole school of understanding. The way I look at the Bitcoin base layer, it's like a cargo ship. Every Bitcoin block contains very, very dense and expensive information. And what I suspect we will see is that there will be a lot more Lightning channels or whatever other layer twos exist that kind of write down that periodic data to the chain. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, if Bitcoin really does go to the kind of trajectory where we think it is and become that base layer of finance, we will have a very different system where you'll have to actually monitor what's going on this layer two, that layer two, what's going on across, you know, Xiaomi and eCashes and all these different kind of iterations of scalability. Some we'll be able to see, some we will not. And it will all come down to understand this economic system based on those constraints.
And it's funny you mentioned that phrase economic again. So unlike some of the other competitors in the space, the fact that you're looking at the economic implications of the data you can get your hands on, it might not matter so much that you cannot see every single Lightning transaction.
Yes.
And this is me just riffing off what you're saying. The key is the trend, right? The trend is your friend. So how many Lightning nodes actually exist? Well, you're never going to know exactly. But are they growing? Yes. Is it growing faster this month versus last month? I don't know. And these are the kind of questions that you can start to pose that, I guess, help you create a picture that is then a useful thing for someone to use.
No, I'm very glad you touched on that, because there's actually a concept I've been looking at recently. So a big narrative back in 2021 was, oh, but all the trading happens on derivative exchanges. So therefore, on-chain data doesn't have the value that we all think it does. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go into this market cycle with that in mind and try and look for how these things, like, are they correct? Is that thesis correct? Now, what I have found is that the on-chain data consistently carries the same signals that it always has. But they're right. Most of the trade volume is happening in derivatives exchanges, which will show up in, you know, open interest and liquidations and funding rates and all that stuff. But what is actually going on here is, for me personally, I described my story before, I used to use derivatives. I don't really use them that much anymore. So therefore, where am I imprinted in all the data that we have? I'm on-chain. My data right now is in on-chain transactions. Many HODLs will be the same. Now, do I also, right, when I'm buying and if I go to sell, there will be an on-chain footprint that I leave. So the way to think about this, for anyone who's familiar with statistics, there's a statistically significant sample size. If you have a network of 1 million people and you ask one guy his opinion, probably not going to be statistically significant. If you ask 10%, now you're probably talking about a meaningful chunk of people. So the average of that answer will probably be representative of the average of the other 90%. So for every guy, and I've run a series of checks looking at this, for every guy who's putting on a levered long and buying a futures contract in all the excitement and the hype, there's another guy who's sending his coins on chain in profit to an exchange. One guy will show up in the derivatives data, one guy will show up in the on-chain data, but they are still both behaving the same way because they are a statistically significant proportion of the Bitcoin market. So these decisions are all happening within a significant cohort of people. And considering that, you know, some like 86% of all Bitcoin, at least to our best estimate, is off exchange, that's a lot of Bitcoin, right? Now, of course, there's a lot of lost coins there, but that's still a lot of Bitcoin. So there's still a huge chunk of people. And this is the other thing people don't realize. There's hundreds of millions to billions of dollars worth of Bitcoin in and out, both directions, every single day to exchanges. So it's enormous, right? Hundreds of millions. And when you look at like the net, right, take all the deposits minus withdrawals, it might be like 5,000, 10,000 Bitcoin. But if you look at the total inflows, it's like 60, 70, 80, 100,000 Bitcoin a day. It's enormous numbers. So all of those transactions came from a guy who bought at some price and he's selling at a different price. So there's all this information baked into their behaviors. So yes, trade volume happens on derivatives, but there's still a whole lot of people who express their opinion via the spot markets and via on-chain Bitcoin.
So interesting, isn't it? Ultimately, it's complex. This is where the analytics that you do is so interesting because it helps to kind of, as you mentioned many times, simplify what is complicated, essentially. I'm not one for guessing games, but you can use these tools to at least attempt to predict a future. As we close up towards the hour, James, where do you think the market's going over the next like 18 to 24 months? Myself personally, I was, you know, fortunate to, I think, time the market pretty well in terms of an entry point last July and also October, December, Jan, Feb, like awesome time to buy. And that's off the back of, you know, plenty of work and some luck, let's be honest. But at some stage when we make new all-time highs in the next kind of, you know, 2 years, I'm looking to take 10% of my stack off the table and pay some bills. And, you know, it depends how high it's gone, who knows, but I will sell some. And people go, don't do that. But do you know what? I'm going to use the tools available to leverage my position as best I can. So where's this market going, do you reckon?
Yeah, no, and this is the thing, right? You are essentially, what you just described is the smart money, right? There's a point of conviction that you, once you understand Bitcoin and you spend enough time around it, you become accustomed to how it moves, right? I mean, I spend all day looking at the data. It's like watching this thing's heartbeat, but the heartbeat is all of us making our collective decisions. Now, you mentioned June, that kind of June onwards period. We do a newsletter every single week, which I'm very proud of because we can essentially go back and look at all those snapshots of what the data we were looking at the time. And we essentially started describing, right? Obviously, it's quite challenging as a company. You're trying to put out a newsletter that's informative, but you're also not saying, you know, we can predict the future. But as that June, July, August, and then November with FTX happened, that whole process, textbook Bitcoin bottom, all the same patterns, all the same signals. FTX was a bit of a hyperextension to the downside. It was very much bottom formation territory, and the investor behavior shifted. We got to the point of capitulation where people who bought the top were flushed out and the smart money started aggressively accumulating, particularly after sell-offs, right? Who is crazy enough to step in front of the FTX train? I mean, you were there. The narrative was Bitcoin's dead for 10 years. This industry has been set back by a decade.
It's going to 10 grand. And I was like, 17 and a half. Thanks very much.
That's it. If it goes down to 10, great. I'll get a paycheck next month and I'll deal with that problem then.
It's funny how the brain plays tricks though, because I was like, what if it does? You know, you get twice as much.
No,
don't
absolutely
be greedy. This was the plan. And coming back to trading, it's very, very disciplined. It's like you had the plan, the plan's
stick
in
to
place,
the plan.
Stick to the fucking plan, mate.
Correct. So to answer your question, when I kind of look at the bottom, let's assume that the bottom is in, it certainly looks like one. There's a huge cluster of supply sitting below us of people who sold and some other guy who stepped in and bought. Now, we've actually got two interesting tools that we call them signals. They're dashboards that try to simplify these concepts. The two that we have is spotting tops and bottoms, tries to look for like when a bunch of indicators that are very, very consistent over time at like one or two standard deviations outside the normal boundaries, when all four of them, and they represent mining, they represent hodlers, They represent spending and how much profit and loss people are in. So kind of four different but semi-connected concepts. When they're all in like a statistically high deviation, probably a good sign that things are a bit steamy or, you know, it's all dead. Blood is in the streets. And we have another one, which we call recovering from a Bitcoin bear, which is what are the kind of things you want to see when the market's coming back to life, right? What do green shoots look like? And it's people finally coming back into profit. As price goes higher, people start to take profits, but the market absorbs it, right? Bull markets are where people take profits and the market keeps going. So when is network adoption growing? Are we seeing more people coming in? Is the user base growing? Are mempools full and there's fee congestion? How many of these things are currently happening right now? And anyway, at the moment, all eight of the things that you would like to see at the start of a bull market, that doesn't mean that we're in a bull market, but it means that it's eight things that I would really like to see to say, I'm pretty confident probably a bull market. And when you've got all eight of them, it's better than having none of them, right? It's kind of really simple to say, well, the probability is probably a little bit higher. And then just to close out, over probably the next 18 months, again, nobody can predict the future, but my kind of gut feel and just kind of having watched Bitcoin do its thing cycle after cycle, normally speaking, once we've formed that bottom, my view is that that kind of 25,000 level, that's kind of bottom formation range. There was a lot of coin that changed hands down there. I would be surprised if we spent too much time down there, to be honest, from here on. Can do, but I'd be surprised. We're kind of in this nebulous in-between phase. We're no longer in like deep value where the thing was just stretched too far to the downside. We've more or less mean reverted back towards an average price, right? 30 grand is about the average price that Bitcoin was at over the last cycle. I expect a reaccumulation period. We probably will go higher. We'll probably go a bit lower. And over the macro sense, you zoom out, there's probably 12 months kind of chopping around in a big sideways range. But overall, probably heading higher, right? Over that long arc of time, probably grinding higher like 2016, 2019, that kind of phase where, you know, the average price in 2019 was $8,000. Yes, we went from 14 to three, but the average price was eight. And if you look at eight now, happy days.
Yeah, wow. And it's quite incredible to think that the halving happens under 12 months now, probably.
Yeah.
And so this increased scarcity and this concept of scarcity really kicks in. You know, one of the characteristics of Bitcoin that really gets your brain going is like, what do you mean, like scarcity? And it's so fascinating. Well, James, listen, so that's been an amazing hour. Thank you so much for sharing that. It's a wealth of knowledge that you've picked up. And it's, again, one of those things I find so engaging about getting into the Bitcoin space and talking to people in Bitcoin is the courage and the interest and the curiosity that takes them to where they're at today. And it's just awesome to see. So thank you so much. Last question is, where can people get in touch if they want to reach out and have a chat?
Yeah, for sure. And mates, thanks for having me on, right? These podcasts are great because you learn all and conferences, all these things. When you meet Bitcoiners, you find out just how wide and varied people's backgrounds are. They come from all over the world, all different professions. And the thing that clicks for them is different for everyone, but you've got some of the smartest people in the world converging on the same solution. And once you see it, you don't unsee it, right? It's kind of a one-way street. So in terms of tracking me down, you'll find me on Twitter at _checkmatey. Checkmate was taken, so I had to go with the pirate slang, checkmatey. And look, most of the work that we do at Glassnode, we have a weekly report that comes out called The Week on Chain on a Monday. And then there's a video report that comes out following that on a Tuesday, because some people prefer to kind of watch. And that's like a 20, 25-minute video, basically me talking through the charts and the different concepts each week. But anyway, that's probably the best place to find us. And if you've got any questions, more than happy to answer them.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining, James. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Okay, friends. Nice work. You made it all the way to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this conversation. If you have any questions, then please don't hesitate to reach out. And if you enjoyed the episode, then please rate, like, subscribe, and share. That's it for now. Enjoy the rest of your day. All the best, Jake.